Washington felt a sense of closeness with his faithful slave and agreed to bring Lee to New York as a member of his team of slaves, even though he was unable to perform the duties of a respected valet. William Lee, therefore, began the journey to the nation's capital with the president-elect and his aides Tobias Lear and David Humphreys. Hours away from fulfilling his dream of living in another northern city, he experienced yet another setback. He fell behind the president's entourage, unable to keep up with the hectic pace of traveling. He was left in Philadelphia to see a doctor and to recuperate. He was fitted for braces and appeared in New York on June 22, 1789, more than 2 months after Washington. Also joining the first family would be two other slaves known only as Giles and Paris. Similar to William Lee, Giles and Paris had traveled outside of the Virginia colony when they accompanied the president to the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Proving themselves reliable outside the rural limits of Virginia, they were to serve the Washingtons as postilions, drivers for the president's horse-drawn carriages, a duty that would require a quick study of the streets of New York. As illiterate slaves, these men would have to form fast friendships with New York coachmen, relying upon word of mouth and a circle of New York postilions to learn the geographical layout of the city. That wouldn't prove too difficult. For one, they were serving the decorated commander of the Revolutionary War, and they were very fortunate to find other blacks performing the same duty. Black postilions and footmen were seen as symbols of wealth for the rural gentry in New York. The Washingtons could thus maintain their Virginia customs far from Mount Vernon and do it in style. The president was conscious of the appearance of his slaves, especially bondmen like Giles and Paris, who stood as symbols of urban wealth. He surveyed their grooming habits and attire, asking his secretary to purchase new clothing for them when their outfits became frayed or tattered. Deciding that the caps worn by Giles and Paris were unacceptable, Washington even wrote to Tobias Lear, "I therefore request that you will have two handsome ones, caps made, with fuller and richer tassels at top than the old ones have." Giles and Paris needed to look good. Washington's image depended on it. Austin, Ona Judge's half-brother, and Christopher Shields, the nephew of William Lee, were also to serve the Washingtons in New York as waiters-butlers. These men were undoubtedly accustomed to 18th-century Southern protocol, and not only were they seen as reliable slaves, but they were presentable to a new Northern social circle. They were most likely trained by the ailing William Lee, who knew the likes and dislikes of his master more than any other bondman. Lee would serve as Mount Vernon's transplanted institutional memory, the reminder of a slow and steady Virginia past in a hectic New York present. Christopher Shields was a dour slave born during the Revolutionary era, probably around 1774. Similar to Austin, he belonged to the Park Custis heirs and was not counted as one of Washington's personal slaves. Like Ona Judge, he was young and had a familial connection that placed him among the most trusted of house slaves. Mount Vernon historian Mary Thompson suggests that Shields was one of the few slaves who were literate on the Mount Vernon estate. This skill would most certainly be useful in the new capital city. Older than both Shields and Judge, Austin offered reliability as well as maturity. The only bond women who were set to travel to New York were Ona Judge and Moll, a 50-year-old seamstress. Judge and Moll would serve the first lady as housemaids and personal attendants. Judge would draw her mistress's bath, prepare her bed clothing, brush her hair, tend to her when she was ill, and travel with her throughout the city on social calls. Moll would be responsible for the grandchildren who lived with the Washingtons. Moll would wipe noses, calm anxious souls awakened by nightmares, and make certain that the Washingtons' grandchildren were well-fed and dressed. Ona would help Maul in whatever way she could, above and beyond fulfilling Martha Washington's needs. The two women worked all day and every day under the careful watch of their mistress. The life of an enslaved domestic carried grueling and constant demands. Private time, time away from their mistress and master, was all but fleeting. Mrs. Washington traveled a similar route to that of her husband, arriving first in Philadelphia, where she was to make a few social calls and take a short respite, before traveling onward to New York to much fanfare. Judge watched as a cavalry and honor guard greeted them at the outskirts of the city, welcoming Mrs. Washington and her entourage to Philadelphia. While the First Lady reacquainted herself with her old friend, Mary Morris, wife of well-known financier Robert Morris, Judge tended to her mistress and started to acclimate herself to a new northern pace. They were still several days' travel away from New York, but the time in Philadelphia marked an important transition. Philadelphia was Judge's first encounter with the North, this exhilarating place where enslaved and free blacks commingled. Inevitably, Judge was confused and excited by the examples of black freedom she witnessed, for it was unlike anything she had ever seen. With close to 44,000 residents living and working in the growing city, Philadelphia was teeming with people. Nearly 300 slaves, still tethered to the institution of slavery, called the city of brotherly love their home, yet they were in the minority. When Judge arrived in the city in May of 1789, there were nearly five times as many, or close to 1,800 free blacks living within the city limits. Early anti-slavery literature distributed by Philadelphia publishers forced the city's inhabitants to look at the institution of slavery through new eyes. When Judge arrived in Philadelphia, the most well-known abolitionist broadside, Description of a Slave Ship, had already made an appearance. The 18th-century poster laid bare the brutality and inhumanity of African slavery, creating a visual supplement for all who were interested in the subject of the transatlantic slave trade. In the same month that Ona Judge traveled to Philadelphia, printer Matthew Carey produced the broadside for the newly reorganized Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery and for the Relief of Free Negroes Unlawfully Held in Bondage, later known as the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. Description of a Slave Ship documented how Africans were mercilessly packed into slave ships with no regard to space or hygiene, let alone humanity. The broadside buttressed the constant Quaker conversations about the evils of slavery. It also reminded Pennsylvanians about their decision to prepare for the end of slavery in the Commonwealth. Some of the most revered Philadelphia statesmen joined the crusade to release men, women, and children from the grasp of perpetual bondage, even former slaveholders such as Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was not unlike many other white Philadelphians in that it took him some time to accept and support the ending of African slavery. Yet toward the end of the Revolution, Franklin ceased his connection to human trafficking. He had held a handful of slaves, most of whom ran away or died while in his service, and in 1787 became the president of Pennsylvania's Abolition Society. That same year, the year that Ona Judge came to Philadelphia, Franklin penned several essays that supported national abolition. Martha Washington would make certain to avoid the likes of Franklin during her brief stay in Philadelphia. She had no interest in releasing the slaves at Mount Vernon, who numbered in the hundreds. Instead, she would move quickly to join her husband in New York, shielding her slaves from the contagion of liberty. As Judge started to familiarize herself with northern life, expert astronomer and African-American scientist Benjamin Banneker's predictions of a solar eclipse came true. Although the hybrid solar eclipse was not visible in the skies of North America, Banneker foretold of the event, much to the surprise of his white peers. In ancient times, it was feared that the shadow of the sun signified either death or the end of an era, and in many ways, this was true for the bondmen and bondwomen who found themselves laying over in Philadelphia. On Sunday, May 24th, 1789, the moon sailed in front of the sun. The next day, the party from Mount Vernon left Philadelphia and headed for New York, marking the beginning of a new life for the young slave girl. 3. New York in Black and White. For sale. A likely, healthy, young Negro wench between 15 and 16 years old. She has been used to the farming business, sold for want of employ. Enquire at number 81 William Street, New York, March 30th, 1789. Fugitive slaves lived in the shadows of 18th century cities, searching for anonymity among the masses. In New York, a fugitive named Molly looked for domestic work and stayed close to her new friends. She lived her life looking over her shoulder for kidnappers or officials of the law, all of whom were anxious to lay claim to her vulnerable black body. We do not know where Molly was from or what family, if any, she left behind in bondage. But we know that she selected New York as her hiding place, a city that still clung to slavery but had cracked open the door to black opportunity. Molly's carefulness, however, was simply not enough to keep her from the reach of a local constable who had every intention of following the new nation's constitution. It was his responsibility to arrest men and women who stole themselves from bondage and to make certain that human property was restored to its rightful owner. Molly had to be returned to slavery. Perhaps she fought the constable, however unsuccessfully, succumbing to his strength as he dragged her to the river to board a boat that would return the fugitive to her owner. A mixture of fear and anger would have coursed through the runaway's body as she confronted the failure of her escape and the realization that her re-enslavement was imminent. The constable approached the watercraft and prepared to load his newly found human property when a group of men, white men, appeared. Lawrence Embry, a New York attorney and member of the New York Manumission Society, was among the men who were determined to save the fugitive. They hurled their bodies in front of the constable, took hold of him, and refused to let him carry out his slave-catching task. While Embry and his friends detained the constable, Molly was spirited away. The fugitive was safe for the time being. Embry would face charges of interfering with the law, charges that the prosecutor eventually dropped. The men who had come to Molly's rescue were among a small group of New Yorkers who were ready to end the institution of slavery. These influential men had gathered together just a few years before to form the New York Manumission Society and began the difficult task of persuading New Yorkers to gradually release their slaves. Becoming important allies to black New Yorkers, the New York Manumission Society was committed to thwarting shadowy slave catchers and to preventing the public sale of slaves. These men offered legal aid to fugitives and opened the first of several African free schools for black children. Some of the most well-known 19th century black leaders were educated at the African Free School, including Alexander Crummell, Henry Highland Garnett, and James McCune Smith, among others. As this early band of New York reformers challenged black slavery, free blacks worked to improve life for themselves. Committed black men came together in the tradition of West African societies to form the African Society. Cloaked in secrecy, its founding date is uncertain. However, it is clear that the organization was up and running by 1784 when the poet Jupiter Hammond was invited to speak at the organization. This active and influential black society paved the way for 19th century political and social organizations that focused on the issues of free and enslaved people of African descent. Eventually, among its other goals, this organization would take the charge in fighting for the burial rights of black men and women. In 1788, the year before George Washington's arrival in New York, black residents uncovered the dubious practice of white medical students. In need of cadavers for dissection and research, white students raided black graves, removing bodies for study, and then leaving their remains in bags by the docks. Infuriated blacks came together and petitioned the Common Council to put an end to this practice, but the fight to protect the rights of the deceased and the respect of black bodies crossed over into the 1790s. White reformers who came to Molly's aid and those who fought for the burial rights of black people faced almost insurmountable obstacles. Molly's rescue was a victory, but slavery would live on in New York for decades. Perhaps it was New York's legal safeguarding of black bondage that allowed the new president to feel comfortable bringing his slaveholding customs to his new northern residence. George Washington met his family and the estate's slaves on May 27th in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, where they were greeted in almost the same manner as was the president. In Martha's entourage was Judge, who likely alternated between helping Martha and attending to Eleanor Park, Nellie Custis, and George Washington Park, Wash Custis, the Washington grandchildren, as they crossed the river and arrived in Manhattan. In a little less than 2 weeks, Ona Judge transformed from a rural Virginia slave to one of the most high-profile bondwomen in the new nation. The Washingtons quickly became familiar with the city's social and political movers and shakers, moving around and entertaining at home, with their slaves ever present. It was a very new kind of life, but the Washington family adjusted in good time. Martha Washington made friends, immersing herself into the new role of the First Lady, which included running the president's house as well as managing Mount Vernon from afar. Although private correspondence reveals Martha Washington's personal struggles with the new demands placed upon her, Ona Judge, an illiterate teenager, left behind no such trace. We can only imagine what Judge's transition to northern life must have felt like. It had to have been terrifying, or at the very least, unsteadying. Yet the young bondwoman handled the abrupt change like a seasoned slave. Judge adapted to her new life and work in New York, a routine that offered little in the way of sentimental comfort or familiarity. Her new role as Martha Washington's top servant thrust her into a tornado of constant preparation. The young slave was Martha's go-to girl for just about everything, and it was Judge's duty to know the desires of her mistress before Martha Washington knew them herself. A slave always had to be prepared for anything. Her responsibilities were varied. Coming from a family of talented seamstresses, Judge was responsible for Martha Washington's appearance. She selected her gowns, made small repairs on aging skirts, removing stains, whether they be from food or the dirt from the unpaved streets, and then dressed her. What appeared to be the mundane task of wardrobe selection for the First Lady was actually quite important. A wardrobe lay at the root of one's appearance, and the mistress and her slave girl fashioned an image for the new American aristocracy. Although the First Lady was far from unrefined, her Virginia ways were revamped during her residency in New York. The Washingtons were precedent setters, and citizens and foreigners alike examined their manners and public displays of quotidian life. The president's house on Cherry Street became much more cosmopolitan as the first family found themselves adapting to a bustling city with a demanding social calendar. When Mrs. Washington arrived at Cherry Street, She found the accommodations to be more than acceptable, writing, "The house he is in is a very good one, and is handsomely furnished, all new for the general." Just a few blocks away from the countryside, a reassuring reminder of Mount Vernon for the new First Lady. It faced the East River and was 3 stories high and 5 windows wide. Leased from attorney Samuel Osgood for a sum of $845 per year, a substantial amount of money was required to refurbish the home before the arrival of the president and his family. Similar to other elite New York homes of the 18th century, the house counted 7 fireplaces, as well as the relatively modern convenience of a pump and cistern in the yard. Rooms were enlarged and remodeled for the president's comfort and business affairs, with an extended drawing room for entertaining, and a larger and more appropriate stable and washhouse. An office, large dining room appropriate for formal receptions and dinners, and a smaller, more intimate dining room were located on the first floor. Just above, a drawing room and bedrooms for the family occupied all the space on the second floor. The secretaries had 2 bedrooms on the third floor, leaving the rest of the third floor and attic to be shared by the servants and slaves. Even with the extensions and adaptations, however, the Cherry Street house was quite full. In addition to the president and Mrs. Washington, 2 grandchildren, 7 slaves, William Lee arrived later in June, and additional members of the staff resided with the president. Tobias Lear, personal assistant to George Washington, and 4 additional secretaries, David Humphreys, William Jackson, Thomas Nelson Jr., and Washington's nephew Robert Lewis, all made their home on Cherry Street. There was absolutely no way that Ona Judge and her 6 enslaved companions could complete all of the necessary work of running the president's household on their own. And Tobias Lear had already begun to assemble additional staff. 14 white servants were hired as both live-in and day servants, including coachmen, porters, cooks, waiters, and housemaids. The servants lived in shared tight quarters with Judge and the other Virginia slaves. For Judge, this was most likely the first time that she lived in such close contact with free white servants. Although there were white artisans and overseers employed at Mount Vernon, Judge would have had infrequent interaction with free whites, who worked physically demanding jobs in order to squeeze out a meager living. At home in Virginia, Judge would have spent the majority of her day serving her masters, but she would have lived in the slave quarters, which were separate and distinct from the main house at Mount Vernon. Things were very different in New York, for not only would Judge learn of a free black population, she would sleep, eat, and share other intimate spaces with white servants. We know almost nothing about the lives of the servants who were employed by Tobias Lear, and we know even less about their relationships with the 7 enslaved men and women with whom they cohabitated. What we can imagine is that just as Judge witnessed the freedom possessed by Washington's servants, she also noticed its limitations. White servants grappled with a frightening closeness to poverty, the vulnerability of a job market that still clung to enslaved and indentured labor, and a lack of opportunity that often prevented them from climbing out of destitution. Still, while her white roommates may indeed have been subject to the hostility of poverty, they were free, and Judge was not. Everyone who resided at the Cherry Street mansion, from the new commander-in-chief down to the scullery maid, was learning new responsibilities. The learning curve was steep for Judge. In addition to her priority of service to the First Lady, the leisure-time activities of Nellie and Wash Custis likely became Judge's responsibility as well. The Washington's granddaughter was 10 years old, and her brother was 8, and after her own children died, the Washington grandchildren moved into the center of Martha Washington's life. Although busy with many new duties, The First Lady focused on finding the appropriate tutors and educating the children. According to most accounts, Nellie enjoyed formal learning, while her brother was less enthralled with his academic lessons. During the first few months of his stay in New York, little Wash worked with a private tutor, while Nellie began working with her music teacher, Alexander Reinagel, an Austrian composer and performer. Nellie Washington also learned the art of painting, an 18th-century symbol of nobility and refinement. By the fall of 1789, the Washington grandchildren were enrolled in new schools. Wash at a small private school that counted 7 additional boys, and Nellie became a day student at a newly opened boarding school, Mrs. Graham's School on Maiden Lane. The whirlwind of New York life intensified the demands of Mrs. Washington, and Judge's responsibilities became increasingly formal and public. To complicate matters, the young bondwoman had to interact with her mistress in a much more delicate manner. Martha Washington was homesick and complained about her new life almost constantly, later referring to her time in the North as the lost years. Mrs. Washington wasn't the only one struggling to adjust. New York was both the metaphorical and the literal gateway to an urban early republic. The streets were filled with new adventures in entrepreneurship, culture, and a growing urban citizenry. As the Washingtons adapted to their new life, they did so with trepidation and a longing for the simpler life of Mount Vernon. Washington's life was filled with so many ceremonial duties that he complained about the loss of his own personal time. Washington wrote, "I had no leisure to read or answer the dispatches which were pouring in from all quarters." After his return from war, Washington grew accustomed to and appreciated the 5.5 years of a slower-paced life at Mount Vernon. His preferred lifestyle all but vanished in his new post, and the new president struggled to create boundaries between the personal and the public, a chore that was almost impossible. Anxious not to appear anti-democratic, Washington wanted to maintain an open relationship with the people. But he needed to reel in the constant social and semi-political demands placed upon him and his family. Weekly levees, small receptions where visitors could speak directly to him, seemed a perfect compromise. These audiences with the president began at 3 o'clock every Tuesday afternoon and lasted no longer than an hour. The president was a punctual man, but also somewhat socially distant. He did not like socializing with strangers. It made him uncomfortable. 4 o'clock on Tuesdays couldn't come soon enough for Washington. The president's levees were open to male visitors only, so every Friday, Martha Washington would open the home on Cherry Street to her female friends and acquaintances. Beginning at 7 o'clock in the evening, Mrs. Washington greeted her guests with tea and coffee, as well as lemonade and ice cream. Unlike her husband, Mrs. Washington did not cut her social gathering short, allowing guests to stay until 10 o'clock. In addition, on Thursday evenings, Mrs. Washington and her husband hosted a formal dinner party for which great care was taken with the guest list. It was important for the president to appear impartial, and therefore the dinners hosted on Cherry Street had to include people from all walks of political life, foreign ministers, senators and congressmen, as well as cabinet members, were invited to dine with the Washingtons, an event where Mrs. Washington often carried most of the socializing. Aside from her husband's natural reticence, Washington also suffered from awful dental problems that often caused pain and embarrassment. Mrs. Washington complained about the lack of personal time and solitude she experienced in New York, but few would know her true feelings. She served well as the president's social partner, transmitting an image of grace and respectability. For her part, Ona Judge would have looked forward to these occasions. While the preparation for Mrs. Washington was intense prior to each event, Judge found herself with a bit of free time, a few stolen moments for herself once the dinners and socials began. More downtime came on Saturdays when the president and his family went out for a ride in the coach, sometimes riding around town or traveling out to the countryside. On occasion, the Washingtons followed the 14-mile round, a popular path that took travelers through lower Manhattan. Leaving at 11 in the morning, the president and his family spent a few hours away from the house, offering Judge what must have seemed like a luxurious amount of time apart from her masters. In a home that was filled to the rafters with guests, family, secretaries, servants, and slaves, Judge would have relished this time. In her stolen moments of leisure, it is very likely that she spent time talking to Austin, her brother, or the other slaves about current events, or reminiscing about loved ones back at home in Virginia. Perhaps in these moments, Judge talked with some of the hired servants about New York and its environs. These fleeting respites from her owners allowed for moments of autonomy that helped the young bondwoman come to know her new city and refine her understanding of freedom and slavery in New York. For decades, New Yorkers grappled with the issue of black emancipation. The Revolutionary War found men in the coffee shops of Philadelphia, Boston, and New York discussing the topics of freedom and citizenship, prompting some New Yorkers to rethink their commitment to slavery. But the drive to maintain human bondage was a slow-burning fire that stayed lit well into the 19th century. So Washington's decision to bring 7 slaves from Mount Vernon to his new home on Cherry Street in 1789 was not considered unseemly or unusual. As was the case for many other elite whites, Washington's use of slave labor was acceptable. Governor George Clinton owned 8 slaves, and New York resident Aaron Burr owned 5 of his own. Yet these men were also involved in the New York Manumission Society, as were John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. Although the society engaged in conversation about gradually ending slavery, most of New York's leaders remained uncommitted to this goal. Slave ownership was still a sign of upper-class status, so slavery in New York lived on. Politicians and learned men were not the only ones who raised concerns about the system of human bondage. By the 1770s, religious groups were pushing for, or at the very least, discussing the ending of slavery. The Quakers in Philadelphia jumped to the front of the movement to abolish slavery by disowning all members of the Society of Friends who engaged in the traffic of human souls. Their early ban on slavery not only affected the Quakers in Philadelphia, but also slowly spread across the North. Other religious groups, such as the Methodists, also began to rethink their affiliation with the institution of slavery, and Anglicans, who had appeared more committed to unfree labor, started to educate and baptize black New Yorkers. Yet New York was not quite as progressive as Philadelphia. When Judge and her enslaved companion stopped briefly at the City of Brotherly Love on their sojourn to New York, they inevitably recognized that slavery was on the wane. This realization would have stirred hope and optimism in the heart and mind of a Southern slave. But a strange reversal followed Judge when she left Philadelphia and traveled north. As she entered New York, she found herself surrounded by slaves again, albeit mixed with a significant number of free blacks. As the city continued to grow in size, so did its population of enslaved men and women. But New York would never claim as large a black population as Washington's home state of Virginia. As a black woman, Judge was now in the minority, a stark difference from her world back home at Mount Vernon. 10% of New York's population consisted of black people, and of them, about 2/3 were enslaved. Judge would interact with these men and women, noticing that the wealthiest white men and women owned a large percentage of the city's slaves, though poorer whites were not absent from the slave trade game, as was the case with a small grocer named Hastings Stockhouse. The grocer lived on Cherry Street, but owned no real property and struggled to make a living. Although relegated to the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, Stockhouse owned a slave. It would have only taken a short time for Judge to figure out that the majority of whites who owned slaves didn't own a great number of them. Unlike an estate such as Mount Vernon, which counted its bondmen and bondwomen in the hundreds, most slave owners in New York City held one or two slaves. The majority of those who claimed human property were artisans, such as Stockhouse, living above their small stores and rented shops, placing their human property in the attics and cellars of their already cramped homes. New York slave owners simply couldn't own more than a couple of slaves, for there was nowhere to lodge them, unlike the slave quarters and cabins at Mount Vernon, which allowed slaves to sleep, eat, laugh, and love each other outside the walls of a master's house. What may have been even more surprising to Judge as she settled into residency in New York was that the majority of the blacks with whom she became acquainted were women. Although artisans and other slaveholders who invested in slave labor preferred male slaves, black women, both slave and free, were a significant presence in the city. Northern slavery was different from what the young Virginian knew. In cities of the North and Mid-Atlantic, slavery was an institution that depended upon black women not for their ability to reproduce, but for their agility with the most arduous kinds of domestic work. Meal preparation, cleaning, and sewing were extremely taxing in the 18th century, and without the luxuries of running water or electricity, much of the work required lifting heavy buckets of water and cooking in unbearably hot kitchens or freezing sheds. For most black women who toiled as domestic slaves or servants, their bodies were broken and their time was never their own. Because of her owner's revered status, however, Judge was most likely spared from the most physically taxing labor in the home, as she had to be on call to assist Mrs. Washington and to accompany her on many social visits. While she wouldn't be asked to assist with cooking or heavy cleaning, in many ways, her work would be much more demanding and extremely unpredictable. It was Judge's job to serve the First Lady without being seen. When Mrs. Washington entertained her close friends, Judge was always within earshot. Sunny days prompted Mrs. Washington to call for her carriage, where she could chat with friends and enjoy the fresh air. Passers-by always recognized the First Lady and took note of her entourage. Preceded by a servant, about half mile ahead, and two young gentlemen on horseback, just before them a mulatto girl behind the carriage, and a Negro manservant on horseback behind. Judge, the mulatto girl, was always careful not to intrude on her mistress and her guests. She perfected the responsibilities of a domestic slave. She was always available, but never present. But only 1 month after Judge's arrival in New York, the frantic pace of life on Cherry Street came to a hard stop. The president was in danger. He was gravely ill. Over the course of his 8-year war experience, Washington's health had deteriorated. Difficult and sometimes unsanitary conditions at war, as well as his advancing age, had taken their toll on the president's body. Having survived the war, no one expected the president to battle for his life after he contracted a fever in June of 1789. His febrile body worsened, and a large tumor developed on his left leg. As the tumor grew, Washington became debilitated by pain, was unable to sit, and the situation grew worse by the hour. Well-respected physician Samuel Bard diagnosed the president's condition as a cutaneous form of anthrax and feared the worst. Washington knew that he might not survive, which must have been nothing short of devastating to Mrs. Washington. Having already buried one husband and all of her children, Martha Washington was most likely consumed with fear. Though they wanted to keep his condition private, the physicians extended stay at the president's house, must have proven curious to the Washington's close friends and family. When servants and/or slaves were asked to cordon off Cherry Street, even the public began to wonder what was happening. Straw was placed on the street outside the president's home to dampen the noise of foot traffic, and all who resided within the walls of the president's home understood the seriousness of the situation. By June 17th, Dr. Bard had no choice but to operate on the president's leg. All surgery in the late 18th century was horribly painful, as analgesics and anesthesia were yet to be invented. The surgery was quite serious, and Dr. Bard was forced to remove the tumor, which Tobias Lear later described as very large, and the incision on opening it deep. Washington survived the ordeal, but was left debilitated and unable to sit or walk for weeks, forcing the president to attend to his duties from his bed or sofa. Martha Washington continued to worry about her husband's health, even after he regained his strength by early September. Judge's task was not only to care for Lady Washington as she had been doing, but also now to help calm her nerves and soothe her soul. Still distraught about leaving Mount Vernon, Martha Washington was forced to deal with the mortality of her husband and to imagine what life would be like without her partner. For 3 months, Martha Washington's mood remained apprehensive. Even after the president appeared to be on the road to full recovery, the First Lady remained leery about her husband's health, worried that his responsibilities would take him to an early grave. Finally, with the president relatively healthy, his dental condition never left him pain-free. In February of 1790, the first family relocated to a much larger home on Broadway. The new home was a spacious four-storied building that allowed for the president and his wife to entertain with much more grandeur. Views of the Hudson River, fine carpets, and beautiful furniture appeared more appropriate for the Washingtons and allotted all who resided in the president's house a bit more space. Once his leg was completely healed, the president's obligations increased, forcing him to travel from state to state, often with little rest. And yet again, the president was betrayed by his own body. The First Lady's apprehension about her husband's fragile health seemed a premonition. A few months after the Washingtons settled into their new home on Broadway, the president developed another fever, which refused to disappear. This time, the president couldn't hide his infirmity, and friends and colleagues began to talk openly about their concerns. Pennsylvania Congressman George Clymer wrote, "But it is observed here with a great deal of anxiety that his general health seems to be declining." Influenza spread through the city, striking without regard to status or position, and the president was no exception. By late April of 1790, Washington came down with the virus that served as a gateway for pneumonia. The contagion that ripped through the city and president's body would claim many lives and robbed Washington of much of his hearing. When Dr. Bard, along with other well-known physicians, were summoned to his bedside, Judge once again witnessed the mood of the president's house turn from great optimism to despair. The president coughed up blood and his fever worsened, leading the president's doctors, aides, and his wife to fear the worst. But their deep concerns would soon dissipate because once again, Washington beat the odds. In little more than a month, the president appeared to be out of harm's way. When the summer arrived, the Washingtons and their slaves packed up once again. This time, Judge prepared to return home to Mount Vernon for an extended visit, one in which everyone could take a step back from the frantic pace of northern life. Judge returned to Virginia a changed woman. She had been thrust into the spotlight of serving the most powerful family in the nation during a year that had been particularly strange and perilous. As she watched her owners take their place at the top of the political ladder, she subtly monitored the beginnings of northern black freedom. Though only 16 years old, Ona Judge was no longer a child. She was an experienced housemaid whose eyes had seen plenty. 4. The move to Philadelphia. In the summer of 1790, after a year and a half in New York, the Washingtons traveled back to Mount Vernon for a nearly 3-month visit. The contents in the house at 3941 Broadway had to be packed and prepared for transport to 2 locations. While some of the family's personal items would follow along back to Mount Vernon, the rest of Washington's property would be sent on to Philadelphia, the new site for the nation's capital. Very little information exists to document this sojourn back to Mount Vernon, but Ona Judge must have looked forward to the familiarity of home and to meeting a new family member. Judge's sister, Betty Davis, had given birth to little Nancy sometime in 1790. Meeting her niece and visiting her family and friends at Mount Vernon would be bittersweet, as it rekindled her most intimate relationships, while reminding Judge of a childhood lost and an entrenched system of plantation slavery. Now in her late teenage years, she had become one of the Washington's most valued house slaves, and had witnessed things her family members could only dream of. Neither her siblings nor her mother had traveled to the North. Only Judge's brother Austin could claim the kind of worldliness that she knew. When the carriage returned Judge to the curved driveway at the Mount Vernon estate, the bondwoman would alter her frame of reference. Her eyes would miss the spotting of free black men and women in the marketplace, and her ears longed for discreet conversations about black freedom. On her return trip to Virginia, Judge would confront the fixed reality of her life as a slave. While her lifestyle and duties may have appeared desirable, even glamorous, to the enslaved at Mount Vernon, Judge knew that black Northerners could enjoy much more than she could. Laying eyes upon little Nancy would remind Judge of the deepest dilemmas of slavery. Slave births were moments of celebration and mourning. She would welcome this new baby girl into the family, knowing all too well the kinds of danger, degradation, and violence that lay in wait for her. But Judge was Nancy's aunt, not her mother, and whatever dreams she had of raising her own family were packed away. There was no place in the executive mansion for an infant slave. Motherhood would have to wait for Ona Judge. Martha Washington, who had been so reluctant to join her husband in New York, now found herself saddened that as a result of a political compromise brokered by Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, the capital was moving to Philadelphia. She had grown accustomed to her new status and her expanding circle of friends, and now she had to start over again in a different city. While a holiday back at Mount Vernon most likely tempered her anxieties about the impending move to Philadelphia, the First Lady was burdened with another relocation to plan. Plagued with thoughts of a long and grueling road trip to Virginia, the Washington household made its way through the streets of New York in a farewell procession. The Federal Gazette reported that Mrs. Washington also seemed hurt at the idea of bidding adieu, which they did on August 30th. New Yorkers bid farewell to their president and to their claim on the nation's capital. Following the American Revolution, the location of the seat of government was a point of great debate, with 30 or more cities competing for the right to house the new center of power. New Yorkers and Philadelphians argued that the site of the nation's capital should be along the eastern seaboard, with its quick and easy access for business transactions. Philadelphians were shocked when the Congress abandoned the Pennsylvania State House, later called Independence Hall, and took up residence in New York. In 1788, New York became the official meeting place for the first Congress under the Constitution. Yet behind closed doors, some members of Congress were holding quiet conversations and private dinners where they developed plans to create a federal city that was separate and apart from any other city or state government. Southerners like James Madison led the charge in what would become a decade-long drama around the location of the new seat of power. Virginians in particular, George Washington, were insistent that the permanent location of the nation's capital reside within a southern orbit. The federal city would be splendid, and the hands of slaves would build it. The new federal government rented hundreds of slaves to clear the land, making way for paved streets and thoroughfares. These same slaves would bake the bricks and saw the lumber needed to erect buildings on what had been a desolate swamp. Black men and women's unpaid labor would lay the foundation for what would become the seat of America's power. It was Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson who brokered the famed compromise between Southern and Northern coalitions, in which the federal government assumed all state debt related to the American Revolution in exchange for landing a permanent nation's capital along the Potomac River. The construction of the capital would take close to a decade, and Philadelphia's consolation prize was the temporary relocation of the capital for a period of 10 years, starting in 1790. Philadelphians hoped that the decade-long window of opportunity would allow Pennsylvanians to persuade members of Congress to rethink their decision. Some congressmen were still uncertain about the construction of a capital on the swampy, mosquito-infested shores of the Potomac, and Philadelphians believed that the modernity and cosmopolitan nature of their city could change minds. A grandiose president's house was constructed for the Washington family in Philadelphia, but the president avoided any connection to the opulent structure. As a Virginian, the president was committed to the Potomac location and chose to maintain a residency in the Morris House on High Street. George and Martha Washington spent the summer months readying themselves for the transition to Philadelphia. The couple had learned quite a bit about northern urban living from their New York experience and took great care to plan for an appropriate staff for the Philadelphia residents. Questions about the propriety of slavery notwithstanding, the president and Mrs. Washington had no plans of leaving behind their slaves, and in fact chose to bring additional slaves with them this time. Concerned about a shortage of white laborers in Philadelphia, and displeased with some of the northern practices of white servants, the Washingtons thought long and hard about who should accompany them in November. The president, ever concerned about appearances, would no longer tolerate white servants who appeared unkempt. He revealed to his secretary Tobias Lear that he would not rehire his previous chefs, noting, "The dirty figures of Mrs. Lewis and her daughter will not be a pleasant sight, in view, as the kitchen always will be, of principal entertaining rooms in our new habitation." Instead, he chose to bring his slave Hercules, known for his fine cooking skills. Clearly, the Washingtons were more concerned with the image of cleanliness and refinement than they were about the growing debate over slavery in Philadelphia. The culinary master ran his kitchen with authority. When Hercules's commands were made known, his underlings flew in all directions, trying desperately to please the extremely demanding chef. Hercules must have been respected not only by the slaves at Mount Vernon, but also by his masters. He knew what kinds of foods his master liked, and could eat with or without his dental prosthetics. Moreover, George and Martha Washington were confident that he would prepare impressive and splendid meals for heads of state and foreign dignitaries. Hercules knew that he carried some social capital with his owners, and that his work as a chef was desirable, for he managed to parlay his new assignment in Philadelphia into an opportunity for his son. Richmond, a young and inexperienced slave at Mount Vernon, traveled north with his father to serve as an assistant in the kitchen. The president was less than enthusiastic about his arrangement with Hercules. "Austin and Hercules go in this day's stage, and will unquestionably arrive several days before us. Richmond and Christopher embarked yesterday by water. The former are not from his appearance or merits, I fear, but because he was the son of Hercules, and his desire to have him as an assistant comes as a scullion for the kitchen." Unimpressed with Richmond, the president nonetheless acquiesced, giving the young Richmond an opportunity to travel out of Virginia to learn his father's trade and to remain connected and attached to Hercules. 6 of the 7 slaves who had traveled to New York also accompanied the Washingtons to Philadelphia. Ona Judge, Moll, Austin, and the horsemen Giles Parris and Christopher Shields were all selected to serve the new president and his family in their new home on High Street. Hercules and Richmond would bring the total to 8, with a 9th slave joining them during the president's 2nd term. William Lee's worsening physical disabilities prohibited him from serving as the president's valet. He was removed from service and left behind at Mount Vernon. 4 moves in less than 18 months was a tiring grind for the entire family, but for the 8 slaves who moved north with their masters, it was more taxing. A new set of rules would have to be learned, new communities would need to be formed, and separation from family and friends would once again be experienced. How would Philadelphia differ from New York? How would their new home be outfitted, and would their duties change? Many questions must have filled the minds of Washington's slaves who traveled north, but they could show no trepidation. Little did Ona Judge know that this move would begin a sojourn toward freedom. The journey would be treacherously slow and would take 6 years to complete, but for Judge, Philadelphia would serve as the birthplace of her own freedom. The President's House stood at 190 High Street, also known as Market Street, between 5th and 6th Streets, less than 600 feet from Independence Hall. The house was known by many names, including the Master's Pen House, the Robert Morris House, 190 Street, and the Washington Mansion, but the name most often used by Washington in his correspondence was the President's House. The building was one of the largest homes in the city and had housed several well-known people. Colonial Governor Richard Penn, grandson of William Penn, British General William Howe, American General Benedict Arnold, and financier Robert Morris had all spent time in the house on High Street. But beginning in November of 1790, it became home to the Washingtons, albeit with some modification. Adjustments would need to be made for his family and large staff to live with relative comfort in the home. A wall was demolished, and bow windows were installed, a fashionable statement for the times. Additional rooms were created for servants near the servants' hall and in the attic. 45 feet wide and 52 feet deep, the home was the size of 2 adjacent row homes. With 3 floors and an attic, the president's house would be bursting at its seams once the Washingtons and their entourage arrived. George and Martha Washington, along with their grandchildren Nellie and George, Washy, would find themselves sharing living quarters with the president's 4 secretaries and chief of staff Tobias Lear. Lear's wife Mary and their toddler Benjamin also lived at High Street, with 8 slaves and approximately 15 white servants. Judge would spend the next 6 years of her life living in a household that counted between 25 and 30 residents. Privacy was an impossibility for the slaves and servants who lived at the president's house. It was hard to come by, even for the Washingtons themselves. The wide stoop of 3 white marbled steps greeted the family. When entering the house, the first family met a long hallway, approximately 50 feet in length, that was carpeted in green and extended up the stairs. Wainscoting was painted along the passageway walls, and mahogany doors accented the 2 dining rooms, one used for the family and another for more formal state dinners that could seat up to 30 people. In the center of the first floor was the kitchen, a large room that was now in the hands of Hercules and John Vicar from Baltimore, who was later replaced by Samuel Francis, also known as Black Sam. Attached to the kitchen were a washroom, a servant's dining hall, the steward's room, 2 bedrooms for white servants and their wives, and a closely located bathing room. The rear of the property included a stable, a cowhouse, a coach house, and a smokehouse that was converted to accommodate sleeping space for slaves. hanging glass lamps, mahogany railed stairs, and the house clock, perched on the second floor landing, provided a stately decor for the new home of the president. The second floor was the exact same size and scope as the first floor, but functioned in a different capacity.